This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and we will begin today with the verdict handed down in the case against Barry Cadden, former co-owner of the New England Compounding Center. Cadden was charged with murder, racketeering, and fraud in relation to the 2012 nationwide fungal meningitis outbreak that killed more than 60 people and sickened hundreds. Today, a Boston federal jury found Cadden not guilty of second-degree murder and guilty on more than 50 other lesser counts. Here's Cadden's attorney, Bruce Singel, speaking just after the verdict was handed down.
It is a disgrace that he was charged with murder. It was unprovable, unwarranted, and unjustified, and we are deeply grateful that the jury saw it that way.
U.S. Attorney William Weintraub was also grateful to the jury, despite the not guilty verdicts on murder. He believes that Cadden is being held accountable.
The tainted drugs distributed on Mr. Cadden's watch caused the largest public health crisis in this country ever by a pharmaceutical drug. Mr. Cadden knew that he was running his business dishonestly, but he kept doing it that way to make sure that the money kept rolling in.
Milton Valencia is a reporter with the Boston Globe. He's at federal court and has been covering this case. Milt, it's good to have you back on the show.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, what was Cadden's demeanor? What was his reaction when he heard all those not guilty verdicts on those 25 second-degree murder counts?
You know, strangely, he was somewhat stoic, indifferent. I made sure to take a look at him before the verdict was announced. This was a lengthy verdict announcement, 90-something charges, 21 pages. He sat calmly, upright, hands on the lap, and, 50 counts into it, he remained the same. Couldn't really tell an expression either way. He has been somewhat that way throughout this trial, and he remained remained so at the end.
Fascinating, because had he been found guilty on those murder charges, he could have faced life in prison, right?
Right. I would tell people that I don't know if we would have had the same trial if the murder charges were not brought here. This is a difference. This verdict, even though Mr. Cadden was convicted, is the difference of a life sentence compared to a few years. So one would expect celebrations. It's a mixed verdict on all ends. I think both sides are disappointed, but I think this is really a difference of not having a life sentence.
And so specifically, Milt, what was Cadden found guilty of then on those other charges?
So this was a racketeering trial, which means he allegedly did run the pharmacy like a criminal enterprise, and the jurors found that. They found him guilty of racketeering. They found that Mr. Cadden was reckless. He skirted, industry regulations to boost profits. He would tell people he tested. He went out and told people he had the best product, state-of-the-art technology, when really he wasn't testing products at all, sending them off. We had a shoddy workplace, and at one point in 2012, that shoddy workplace led to the contamination of drugs, and Mr. Cadden shipped contaminated drugs to customers knowing the health risk.
Right. So, and the possible sentences associated with those guilty verdicts?
So on the fraud and racketeering charges, he faces up to 20 years in prison on each charge. He would not get 20 years under sentencing guidelines. This is a man who did not have a criminal record beforehand. But as you said, this is more than 50 counts. So those charges pile up at this point. So though it's not a life sentence, it could be a lengthy sentence.
Yeah. So, but Milton, back to those second-degree murder charges. Again, Cadden was found not guilty on all of them. I mean, what was the case that the prosecution was trying to make? I mean, they failed to make their case, but what were they saying in trying to convince the jury that Cadden should be found guilty of murder?
Well, there was a lot of critics who said this was a jump here. There was no denying, even by Mr. Cadden's own lawyers, that something bad happened. This was a horrible incident. It was a tragedy. And the jury found that there was fraud and there was kind of wrongdoing at the pharmacy that led to contamination. The jury had to find that Mr. Cadden wantonly and with total disregard for what he was doing, knowing that sending out those shipments could cause someone to die. That's the standard jurors had to find, that he knowingly put this drug out there, knowing it was contaminated, knowing it could cause death, and that he did it recklessly anyway. And that's a jump that jurors were asked to make, and at the end of the day, they found this was a contaminated work site. They found that Mr. Cadden shipped these drugs when he shouldn't have, but they weren't willing to make the jump that doing so actually caused deaths and that he was responsible for those deaths.
Right. I understand that Cadden is scheduled to be sentenced in June. Is that right?
June 21st. And again, this is not a life sentence, but if you add up all those fraud and racketeering convictions, they do add up.
Yeah. And finally, Milt, are there other trials or other legal actions associated with this case that today's verdict could have an influence on?
Yes. So Mr. Cadden was part of a criminal enterprise. He was the head of the criminal enterprise. He was the first to go to trial, and he's the only person who has gone to trial at this point because he was the head pharmacist, the co-owner, and he really stood out there in that sense on his own. But at least one other person has been charged with causing death as well. That's the supervisory pharmacist Glenn Chin, as well as some other pharmacists and technicians who were also allegedly involved. The jury did find a racketeering enterprise, so that case against them will continue. The question is whether jurors will want to pursue these murder charges against Mr. Chin.
Or if prosecutors will, maybe more importantly.
Yes, the question is whether prosecutors will want to. And Bill Weiner, who you heard earlier, would not say otherwise. Either way, he has to look at the jury's verdict and really kind of come to a conclusion of what the evidence is. But as of now, he's not saying, and Mr. Chin is scheduled to go to trial in April.
Milton Valencia, federal courts reporter for the Boston Globe. Milt, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's get some thoughts from one of the victims of that 2012 meningitis outbreak. Army Major Adam Ziegler joins us now from Fort Stewart, Georgia. Major Ziegler, welcome to the show. And let me just start by asking you, as you heard, Barry Cadden was found not guilty for those second-degree murder charges, guilty of racketeering and conspiracy and mail fraud. I mean, just overall, what's your reaction to that verdict?
I'm glad that some kind of verdict has finally come. This has been a long road for everybody that's been involved. You know, as a victim, it's been over 4 years since this all started. It's going to be a long road, and it's just good to see something finally come of it.
Do you feel like justice has been done?
I guess that justice has been done. You know, it's been through the legal system, and this is what the folks who had to sit on the jury have decided. As far as, you know, whether it's anyone's ever going to be made whole in this, or whether if he'd have been found guilty of 25 counts of second-degree murder, if it would make me feel any better, it really wouldn't matter. He's going to be punished, and all the rest of us are still going to have to go on with our lives as wherever we are, either without somebody or you know, dealing with whatever pain or injury we have for the rest of our lives.
Yeah. Well, Major Ziegler, if you could, can you tell us a story of what happened to you? I understand that you were seeking treatment, a steroid injection, after you got an injury on parachute jump training. Is that right?
Yeah, I had an injury that steroid injection was, in theory, the least invasive way we can go, and it'll help get you back to 100%. You know, when I got my injection, I was still running, you know, for recreation several miles a week, still taking a PT test, you know, no impact on my duty. This was just to kind of get me over that little bump so I could be 100%. So I went to Nashville and got an injection in my SI joint, and a few days later I started having some pain. And then just got progressively worse until the point that I was finally hospitalized. And then the hospital contacted Vanderbilt, and they sent up some antifungal drugs and said, hey, try this. There's something going on. We don't know what. And turned me back around.
Well, if I may ask, I understand that doctors found fungal infections in your joints, in your bones, in your muscles. Sounds like almost all over.
It started in my SI joint, and because it had time to just kind of sit there and grow, it had grown into my pelvis. And so I ended up having to do a two-year course of antifungals to fight it off. You know, I had at one point I had my infectious disease doctor, my oncologist, my orthopedic doctors, and a nerve doctor all at once at Vanderbilt. So I was getting worked over pretty well. But it took 2 years to get it to the point where they said, okay, it's not active. And that's kind of where I'm sitting at now. Kind of, I am what I am. You know, whatever damage I had from the antifungals, everything is as good as it's going to get.
And what kind of damage do you have? What kind of damage are you living with?
What I have is bad enough. I am getting medically separated from the military. It's been kind of an ongoing trying to see how much better I can get, seeing what I can do. You know, even sitting is kind of rough. There's no comfortable way to sit. I can't run anymore. You know, I can't even pick up my my daughter. She's not quite 2 years old, and carry her around for very long.
Well, Major Ziegler, it sounds like you are taking the challenges that have been thrown at you with incredible grace and determination. What are you going to do next after receiving your medical separation from the Army?
I'm not sure. You know, it depends on what the military does with me. It can do anything from just separate me to actually some type of retirement. So still don't know what's going to happen there. And then I'm trying to figure out, you know, kind of what I can do with what I've been dealt here. You know, I'm blessed that I'm alive, and you know, I'm not in a wheelchair or worse. And so I'm just trying to work with what I've got, and I just want to find some type of job when I get out of the military that's still a meaningful for me and meets the needs of my family and myself.
Hmm. Well, Major Adam Ziegler spoke to us today from Fort Stewart, Georgia. Major Ziegler, thank you so much for sharing your story and for joining us today.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
So Major Ziegler and his family are but one of the hundreds of people across the country who were terribly affected by this meningitis outbreak. I mean, how did all of that happen in the first place? How could one compounding pharmacy send out so many contaminated treatments across the nation? Well, in the aftermath of the 2012 outbreak, it quickly became clear that pharmacies like the New England Compounding Center fell into a regulatory gap between state and federal agencies. Since then, officials at both levels have tried to strengthen oversight of compounding pharmacies, but have they closed that gap entirely? Joining us now with an answer is Kevin Ouderson. He served on a special Massachusetts commission formed to investigate compounding pharmacies after the 2012 outbreak. He's also co-director of the health law program at Boston University. Kevin Ouderson, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
So this regulatory gap between state and federal agencies back in 2012, what was it and why did it exist?
If this drug was made by Merck or Pfizer, you know, a big company that we've heard of, it's completely regulated by the FDA. But since it was made by a compounding pharmacy, it's a category that the FDA had precious little regulatory oversight. And at the time that this happened, states like Massachusetts also had inadequate oversight.
And so inadequate oversight, why? I mean, one would think that anything that that is injected or consumed as a medicine would fall under some sort of regulatory observation.
Again, if a drug company is making it, it goes through every process that the FDA has. But they treat, historically, compounding pharmacies as if it's the pharmacist around the corner who gets out his mortar and pestle and makes up an oral version of a normal drug for one of his regular customers. So that's the mentality. That's the thought.
Dating back for a long time?
Hundreds of years. Okay. Right? But for this case, this was a company that took that idea, a compounding pharmacy making special preparations for a few of their local patients, and turned it into a national business.
I see. So are we dealing with things with an issue then or a regulatory structure that failed just specifically in this case? Or, I mean, does it tell us that this could possibly happen again?
It certainly could happen again. This specific example, if they had made the steroid, the injectable steroid that was at issue in this case, if they had made it the normal way, it would have been regulated by the FDA. But they deliberately made it without the preservative. And that enabled them to say that the population this was going to be used for were people who were allergic to the preservatives. And so that was the theory, the regulatory theory that made this compounding as opposed to drug manufacturing. Ironically, that's a disaster.
Right.
Because the steroid had fungal contamination. A preservative might have saved the lives of all these people that have been either killed or damaged.
So we talked about why FDA oversight prior to 2012 wasn't applicable in this case, but guide me through what Massachusetts state regulations were at this time that didn't catch this.
We don't regulate any other national health product like this. Okay, so None of the victims were in Massachusetts. So Massachusetts did a fine job protecting local residents. But these drugs were shipped to Michigan and to Tennessee. You know, a lot of the victims were in Nashville and Michigan and on the East Coast. They weren't in Massachusetts. And so it's hard for the Tennessee Board of Pharmacy to regulate this operation, you know, in central Massachusetts.
Right.
Same with the people from Michigan and same for the people from any other state. It's the sort of thing that calls out for a national regulationist instead of state by state.
Okay, so, I mean, we just heard from Major Ziegler beforehand. He was in Nashville when he got that treatment. I mean, it's just stunning to think that you'd have to wonder when getting what should be a routine treatment, where did it come from and was it adequately regulated? Have there been any moves to produce some sort of stronger federal oversight then?
Immediately after the outbreak, Congress held hearings. I remember very clearly that officials from Massachusetts went and actually apologized and said, we're going to do better. This Commonwealth of Massachusetts has done better. But Congress had a bill, and the original version of the bill would have closed this loophole. The part that was passed, the bill was passed, the Drug Quality and Security Act, left it up to the compounding pharmacies to decide whether or not they would be regulated by the FDA.
Okay, so hang on. So we're asking the pharmacies themselves to choose federal oversight.
Correct. It was the compromise that came out. The original version of the bill was much stronger. The one that passed made it their choice, the pharmacy's choice.
Do we know how many pharmacies have opted for federal regulation?
Actually, you know, a number have, right? And they're able to say when they sell to hospitals nationwide now, we're selling you a compounded drug that's regulated by the FDA. It's a sticker of quality assurance. But there still remains hundreds of compounding pharmacies who have not regulated, who have not volunteered to be regulated by the FDA. And for them, we just don't know exactly what the quality assurance procedures are in any given state.
I am not comforted at all by hearing this. I can't imagine very many listeners are, because it sounds like we've made very little progress since 2012.
Some states have made progress for their own residents. So the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, because we were the epicenter, spent a lot of money to upgrade the regulations for Massachusetts. But that doesn't do anything if the drugs were shipped from here to someplace else, or really it's hard for a Massachusetts regulator to inspect a plant in Texas or Florida or someplace else. So there's still tremendous gaps, without a doubt.
Well, I'm seeing here that the International Academy of Compounding Pharmacists, they have said that the FDA and the Massachusetts Board of Pharmacy had, quote, clear authority to investigate and to take action that would have stopped the operations at NECC, and both had been, previous to 2012, informed of problems there, and neither took action, or neither did. So is Massachusetts, I mean, you sort of hinted this, at this earlier, is Massachusetts better suited now to take action if notified of certain problems?
In the aftermath of this, then-Governor Patrick deployed significant efforts to upgrade the regulations in Massachusetts and to hire more people to do inspections. For the first time, we had surprise inspections as opposed to, you know, prearranged inspections of every compounding pharmacy in the Commonwealth. And they found many that had some deficiencies and they corrected them. So in the immediate aftermath, Massachusetts did a good job. But I think the question is, you know, where is there a compounding pharmacy someplace in this country right now that's not meeting standards, and how would we know? And would you know, when the doctor's about to give you an injection, exactly where that drug came from and whether it was FDA regulated or not?
It sounds like patients can't know.
I think they should ask. But it may be that, you know, for the pain clinics in Nashville that Major Ziegler was at, the physician may not have known. It may have been the decision of somebody many steps away from the doctor or nurse who chose this product as opposed to an FDA-regulated product.
So it's finally, it sounds like, I mean, what is the ultimate solution here? Do we need a federal law to close this gap entirely?
My preference would have been for the original version of the Drug Quality Security Act as opposed to the one that passed Congress.
Well, Kevin Ouderson, he served on a special Massachusetts commission to investigate compounding pharmacies that was formed after the 2012 meningitis outbreak. He is also co-director of the health law program at Boston University. Thank you so much for joining us.
Take care and be careful out there.
Remember, always ask.
That's right.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.